So tonight, you are actually going to get the secret teaching. You know, there's like a little extra on that Friday night because I get to talk about what we're going to do all weekend. And I get to talk about it with enough time that I can explain it. And we can talk about it and we can ask questions about it. And then we spend the Saturday and Sunday practicing with what we talked about. And so tonight is this opportunity to kind of explore into this topic of unshakable peace. And I want to use a term called Viveka. And I practiced with Viveka in December. It was so profound to me that I decided I was going to spend the whole year talking about it, like the whole year. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So we're going to sit for about 30 minutes, and then I'll do a talk. Well, we'll take a break, and then I'll do a talk, and then we'll open it up for questions and see what comes up for us. So for those of you that came after the meditation started, I was telling people that, you know, you're going to get the secret teachings tonight because once the Saturday and Sunday starts, you can't really, the talks are shorter and most of it is practice. And so tonight, I really get to talk about why I think this term, Viveka, which we don't use very often, is so important. I didn't actually plan on, spending my December retreat practicing with Viveka. I've heard of the word, but it was like body Viveka, kaya Viveka, or sometimes I've heard chitta Viveka. Viveka is a seclusion of the mind. But somehow I just intended to sit with the older, long gone masters from Thailand. And so I got a lot of recordings about from Ajahn Chah and downloaded Ajahn Buddhadasa and Upasaka Keys and all these different Thai people because I'm a Thai practitioner. And I just downloaded them and I did just like a regular retreat. I just do the sit walk all day, have my stuff downloaded, morning instructions, Brahma Viharas, Dhamma talks, and then I just listen to them. And I stumbled. I mean, I guess I downloaded it, but one of the talks that I downloaded was from Buddhadasa about seclusion. And, you know, if you think about this word seclusion in English, it's such a limiting language when it comes to the Dhamma. It's a good thing that the Buddha spoke Pali and not English. Because English can be very stoic and very rigid in its languaging, but that is not the way Ajahn Buddhadasa talked about seclusion. It was quite beautiful and quite engaging. And so hopefully I can bring about that same kind of understanding because I decided, wow, this is what I want to talk about all year because of what we are living in. And seclusion, while the word itself in English evokes this kind of separate, closing off, not you, it's kind of like this pushing away. That is not what seclusion is in Dhamma. It is protection. It is a way in which you can learn and we have the capacity to cultivate a protection in our lives that's much stronger than the chaos that we happen to be living in. So anyway, so I listened to this talk from Buddhadasa, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what he said. But I was laying in the bed, and I just kept thinking about this talk. It's nothing like what I thought of as seclusion. And at some point, I realized that I looked over at the recording, and he gave that talk in May of 1986. I'm positive, even though I can't find the talk now. I mean, I just have this bad habit of, as soon as I listen to something, I just delete it, you know? I'm like, dang it, I wish I would stop doing that. But nonetheless, I deleted it, and I can't find the talk. But I remember looking at, when did he give that talk? And it was May of 1986. And in May of 1986, I was in a completely different world. I was not anywhere near the Dhamma. I was a single parent with two kids trying to find a job. I just got out of undergrad and couldn't find a job, and I was on welfare. Like, I was thinking to myself, you know, like, on welfare? I just got my college degree. Something's wrong with this system. But there were no jobs. Reagan was in office. Everybody was scared to death. We thought the world was coming to an end. Little did we know it was going to get worse. But still, we thought the world was coming to the end because there was nothing. It was just terrible what was happening to the country. And I was laying there realizing that it's not like my life is dramatically different, right? I'm still worried about the future, still have all this kind of chaos going on around the world, and everything is still the same. It's just very difficult, and jobs are hard, and it's just money is tight, and so it's the same world. I don't have two kids. I mean, sometimes they act a little bit like they're still little, but I have more ability to just say no. So, but the world is the same. And I was laying there realizing I am not the same. That is what's different. It's not the world, it's me. I don't have the same capacity. I don't have the same angst and panic and kind of fear of the future that I had back then. And I realized that I was living into the seclusion that Ajahn Buddhadasa was talking about. That it wasn't just some words and, you know, kind of like, you know, feel good stuff. That the Dhamma really does have a capacity for seclusion. And that seclusion, what I realized, was this sense of confidence and surety. When you're secluded in the Dhamma, what you get is not isolation. You get confidence. You get a steadiness, this unshakable peace that can exist in the midst of anything. And so I just had this moment when I realized, wow, things like this is what we need to be talking about over the course of the year. This is what we need to sort of support each other in, is to help each other see just how protected we actually are, so that we don't get caught in the chaos that happens to be going on around us. I mean, you might even step into the chaos because you want to. Like my friend Shelley Graff was in the thick of it during Minnesota's, what they call, what do you call it when a country takes over another country? The occupation. That's what they call it. Yeah, they call it the occupation of the winter occupation. So it's sort of like they were in the thick of it. And yet we could find this stillness, steadiness, protection, seclusion that you can cultivate. So that's what I want to point to. And I want to talk about how it is, what it is. And then over the weekend, we'll talk about how to cultivate it. But I want to start with a sutta, one of my favorite suttas. I just think of them as Dhamma talks. And so this would be a Dhamma talk that the Buddha gave, Ananda. It's called the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness. And so I'm going to kind of squish together conceptually emptiness and seclusion. Because emptiness, again, is one of those words that we think it means somehow it's void of everything. It's nothing. Nothingness is what we think of as emptiness. And there is a nothingness quality to it, but it's very much an everything. And so that is the same with seclusion. And so I want to use this sutta to kind of point us step by step into what it is that we're going to talk about. So the sutta starts with this conversation that the Buddha had with Ananda. And Ananda goes to the Buddha. I guess the Buddha had given some Dhamma talk, and he had made the statement that he now remains fully in a dwelling of emptiness. And Ananda goes to him because Ananda was the keeper of Buddha's talks. He was the keeper of his language. He had a memory, and he had a capacity that he could remember. And so he could sync together what the Buddha said, and then he could go and teach a group of monks. You remember this talk, and then you remember this talk, and you remember this talk, and then all these monks would recite these talks, and that's how they had this oral tradition of constantly regurgitating Buddha's Dhamma talks over and over and over and over and over. And so Ananda goes to the Buddha to check with him to see if he heard what he said. Was he wanted to check to see if he heard that correctly, if he learned it correctly, if he attended to it correctly and remembered it correctly, that you now remain fully in a dwelling of emptiness or seclusion, you could say. And Before I go to the Buddha, his answer to Ananda, I want to frame something a little bit. The reason why I think Ananda had to go ask the Buddha this is my thoughts, right? I think it's because the Buddha was very active, right? He wasn't dwelling in seclusion the way you would think of in a cave somewhere, all tucked in and not really engaging with the world at all. Buddha engaged with the world from the minute he walked out there and started teaching. He had all kinds of people around him. He had all kinds of dignitaries and ministers and kings and people, wealthy people, poor people, all kinds of people coming to see him. So wherever he walked, there would be crowds and crowds of people. So it's not like he was in a cave practicing. He was very much engaged. I think about Bhante Buddharakita, who gave me my precepts, and he's in Uganda. He has a monastery there. It's active. It's big. I mean, it's got all kinds of kids and all kinds of nuns, all kinds of monks. they do so much. It's a whole school and a whole nunnery and a whole monastery itself. And there's all these things going on all the time that he has to engage with all the time. But he still has this access to seclusion. So this, or some of you even know the monks here at the Clear Mountain. They have a seclusion about them, and yet they're engaged in all kinds of things, you know. They're like high tech, you know, massive. They can engage with so many people on so many levels, and yet they have this seclusion. And so there's a quality here that we're pointing to that's not what you think of as seclusion. So the Buddha looks at Ananda. He tells him, yes, Ananda, you heard that correctly, learned it correctly, attended to it correctly, remembered it correctly. Now, as well as before, I remain fully in a dwelling of emptiness. And I think that now, as well as before, either is pointing to the Buddha's recognition before, when he was awakened and he was in the midst of deep samadhi, or even when he goes into meditation in samadhi and then comes out, that the distinction that we make doesn't exist. That whether he is in meditation or he's out and about doing things, he still dwells in this emptiness. And that is not something only monastics can access. That's why I'm telling you that even though they're monastic, they still engage with the world in a lot of engagement, and yet there's this quality of seclusion that they can have access to that even we as householders, lay practitioners, we still can have that same access. So the way that the Buddha explained how he could do this is what I want to talk about. He used the place they were staying at, which is Megara. It's called Megara's Mother's Palace. Megara's Mother's Palace. And at that palace, I guess Megara's mother had money, and she gave the land to the Buddha for his monastics, and they had a monastery there. And so the Buddha was saying, this is Megara's mother's palace, and that it used to have a lot of dignitaries, people, cows, animals, money was exchanged. There was all this stuff going on. But that stuff that happens in a palace doesn't exist there now because it's a community of monks. And so what he was saying was that even though those kinds of things still happen, they are not happening in this place. They are not happening right here. And it is empty of those disturbances. And instead, it has the community of monks. But then he said, but you know, the community of monks has our own disturbances. And so there's even though we don't have the disturbances of, say, a village or a palace, it's empty of that. It does have this. And you could move to the wilderness, go to a wilderness, sit under a tree all by yourself. And you could begin to see that you are, that the disturbances, even of a community of monks, no longer exist. But then being at the foot of a tree trying to meditate has its own disturbances. So it might be empty of other people, but even sitting there by yourself has its disturbances. And you could get even further by putting your attention on a single object. Like he was using the elements. You could just steady your attention on the elements and steady there one element at a time. And then it would be absent or empty of the disturbances of whatever's going on while you're sitting there. Like what I think he's saying is, it's empty of the mental hindrances that hinder meditation, and you can steady your attention on one object and settle there. So what he's doing is doing this gradual descent into emptiness, or a gradual descent into seclusion, by noticing the absence of certain disturbances. Some disturbances still exist, but you notice it's empty of those disturbances, empty of those, and gradually you descend into this single-pointedness. And that single-pointedness is what I think Viveka is. I think seclusion is it's English, so it's problematic, but it might be that we can understand seclusion better than we can grasp emptiness, and struggle with whether something exists or not if it's empty. We have a tendency to think, like non-self, that means I don't exist. Yes, you do exist, and everybody knows that you exist. Even with all those habits you think don't exist, everybody knows that it does. So it's not that you don't exist, but you're not only that, and you're not separate from whatever is happening. So likewise, this emptiness, if we begin to think of it as this sense of seclusion, this gradual descent into emptiness is what we're going to talk about over the course of this weekend. And it might seem like, oh, I need to have a retreat and I need to be in lockdown for a month, like you were, Tuareg. That's where I'm going to get it. But really, you don't. You don't. That is what the Buddha's pointing to, that it's not that you have to tuck away and be gone. There is something nice about getting tucked away. That's why we're tucked away for the weekend. But even the weekend is enough tuck away for you to begin to see the absence of certain disturbances. And that's what we're going to cultivate. So let me talk a little bit about Viveka. Viveka is V-I-V-E-K-A. And the V-I-V stands for utmost, like highest. And Veka, V-E-K-A, stands for single. So it's the utmost singleness is what Viveka means. How that got to seclusion, I don't know. That is the English translators. That's why the word is difficult. So, but there is a singleness that you are pointing to. And this is what I think the Buddha was telling Ananda, that you begin to focus your attention singly towards something by noticing what's not here. What's not here, you gradually focus your attention to the singleness of this one thing. And Viveka shows up in three ways: physical, and that's kaya, body, Viveka, and mind, mental, chitta, Viveka. And I'd heard about those two, but what made Buddhadasa or Ajahn Buddhadasa's talk so profound for me is he talked about upadhi Viveka, which is what he called spiritual Viveka, which is kind of weird because upadhi means baggage. It's all the mess we carry around, our habits, our accumulations, all the things we've accumulated over the years. That's what upadhi is, all of our stuff, our stuffing that we have. And you are secluded from all of that stuffing is what he's saying. There's a way that you can cultivate your spiritual practice outside of your stuff. And so over the course of the weekend, I want to talk about each one of these. I want to talk about the physical and the mental and the spiritual. But for tonight, I want to point a little bit to what they are. So this kaya viveka is this seclusion, this physical seclusion. So as the Buddha was pointing, you can notice the physicality of Marga's mother's palace, right? Margara, sorry, I keep calling her Marga, but it's Margara. Or Margara, depending on the cadence in Pali. But there is a physicality in where we are. There's a physicality. You can think of the physicality of this building. So we want the building to have a certain ambiance to it that brings a sense of seclusion. All spiritual buildings have this kind of connectability. And then not only is the physicality relating to the place where you're at, like you're in the in this center or at a monastery or tucked away someplace in a wooded area sitting. We can see, you can go to certain places. It's like when we used to go hiking, there'd be certain places where you feel like, yeah, this is where we want to have lunch. It's kind of tucked away. It's kind of, we're kind of by ourselves and we want to sit and have lunch here. It's that kind of a thing. There's a kind of the place itself, the physicality lends itself to helping us feel secluded. But that's not the only way that we could think of it. Ajahn Sumedho one time said that you could think of the Buddha as a physical being, you know, like the historical man that is the Buddha. Or you could think of the Buddha as representing mindfulness. That mindfulness itself is what the Buddha stood on. It's what he articulated and stressed over and over and over, that if you put your kind of a practice into cultivating mindfulness, you are cultivating the Buddha. You are cultivating the essence of what he was saying. And so this weekend, I want to talk about how mindfulness is like this physical viveka, and that you carry that mindfulness with you wherever you go. That it's not just here in this building. It's not just nice parks or nature. You carry it with you. And the more you begin to sense that you carry this physical viveka that you have access to anytime, the more that physical capacity to have that sense of seclusion tucked in, safe and protected, that comes your way. That begins to be a part of your very life. That's what I realized laying in the bed, that no matter what was happening out in the world, I physically felt like I had the capacity to take care of myself, whatever happens. I don't have to walk around being afraid about it. I live on Dana, so it's sort of like you never know what's going to happen. And by the very nature, I had more sure. I was like back then looking for a job for security, because that's how I know I'm going to be secure. And I had more financial problems then than I have now. Because when you live on Dana, you sort of live within the means of what you make now, what you got now, because there's no telling about whether you're going to have anything then. So you have to keep living in this circular idea of what I have now. Whereas before, when I used to get this paycheck every week, I would spend everything I had because I knew I was going to get a paycheck at the end of the week. So money's all gone. I'm just waiting. Oh, there it is. Spend it all. Waiting. I don't live like that anymore. I have way more maturity around money for two reasons. One, it's like when you live on Dana, you're living on someone else's gift, someone else's sort of mudita that they share with you. You can't just squander it. And so you pay more attention to what you're actually doing. And because there's a lack of absoluteness about it, you have to live within the capacity of where you are right here, right now. And so living on Dana, yeah, it's not without its pitfalls, but by and large, over the years, it has taught me a sense of security, physical security. Secondly, this citta viveka is the mind. And we're going to talk about the mind. But the mind, I think it is pointing to this learning to abandon these hindrances that keep showing up in our lives constantly, over and over and over. And they're not showing up in our lives to remind us how bad we are. They are showing up to keep pointing us towards the Dhamma, because that's it. The more you begin to see Dhamma, and that's what I realized, that I don't see, like I used to see problems that needed to be fixed. And I was always looking at everything like, what do I need to do to fix this? How do I need to make this happen more the way I want it to happen? So there was always this kind of push and pull with life to try to make things be the way I wanted them to be. Because if they weren't the way I wanted them to be, of course I think something bad's going to happen. So it's got to be my way, or it's going to be, you know, devastation. And I don't have to do that. I see things as Dhamma. I see things as, you know, dependent origination. I see things as hindrances or, you know, seven factors. I mean, I could list all these things, but what I see is the relationship between what's happening. I can see clinging. I don't worry about what I'm clinging to. I can just recognize, oh, there's clinging there. We need to let that go. Whatever it is, I don't want it now because there's too much clinging in it. So it's almost like if I get my way, I don't want to get my way. You take it. I don't want it. Because if I get my way, the mind will be like, let's do that again. Because that's what we need to do. We need to get our way. Go back to the getting our way. I'm like, nope. If I got that much energy, I don't want it. You keep it. So that kind of seeing the Dhamma in everything creates this seclusion from, let's see, how can I say the words? You are secluded from the conceptualization of life, and instead, you're more moving in the free flow of life, just as it is. And we're going to talk about that we're going to probably not get to this till Sunday, but we'll get to Sunday. And then Sunday afternoon, we're going to talk about spiritual seclusion. So I think Buddha is physical, Dhamma is the mental, and then, of course, you know what the spiritual is. It's Sangha. It is this, we get so attached to our stuff, and we're so attached to our baggage that we cannot see life outside of our baggage and stuff. And when you start interacting with other practitioners and you have Sangha and you have a connection in between, you begin to see how easily baggage is lost, right? Because in a Sangha, somebody just lost their job. Somebody just got diagnosed with something. I mean, it doesn't matter how big the Sangha is. It can be a small Sangha and still somebody's lost their job. Somebody just broke up. Somebody's struggling with some health challenge. Somebody just got some financially bad news. It's always this kind of interacting with life that reminds us continuously of how fragile our stuff is and how limited it is in protecting us. And so there's a way in which you can begin to cultivate and build a level of trust with other practitioners as to where we're going in life, what's real, what's important, what connects us all together. And it's not our stuff. In fact, none of us know what stuff you got at your house. And if we knew, we might think, why you got that? I mean, do you use it? I moved, you know, and I have these boxes that I still have to go through. And I was telling my friend Darrell Williams, I finally figured out why it's so hard to get rid of these boxes of stuff. It's because every time I open up a box, it had a place in my old apartment. I knew where it goes and it fit right in and everything was, you know, it had a place. But now I pick it up. I don't know what to do with it. I've had it so long. I don't know if I should throw it away. I don't know where to put it. It doesn't fit anywhere. So I put it in another box to look at it later. I decided today, I'm throwing it away. If I cannot find where it should go, it's either going to the Goodwill or it's going to the dump. No more. I'm not negotiating with it anymore. And Dara said, you're going to regret that. I said, that's it. I've been in that house for a year almost. And if I haven't opened that box up until today, whatever's in there, I don't even have to open it up. I can just chuck it because I haven't even looked at it. So it's not that important. And so we have to come in relationship with beings so that we can learn to see that we are not our stuff. We have stuff. And we may like it and have a fondness for it, an attachment to it, but we are not the stuff. We are something else. And that seclusion is learning to see that things come and go, you know, life just changes. And it's not saying something about who we are. So these three aspects of what you could call utmost singleness, the utmost singleness of mindfulness. No matter where you are or what's happening, the utmost singleness of being able to find your meditative object and steady yourself is something that we have to practice doing because our minds won't go there naturally. This utmost singleness of remembering the Dhamma and finding, you know, seeing how this relates to Dhamma. It's one of the reasons why I love at Seattle Insight that we do the yearly kind of Dhamma practice so that everything that we're looking at is being framed in some kind of practice. And that over the years, that's how I learned the Dhamma. It's similar to what Rodney used to do. He didn't do it for the whole year. He did it for little segments, but he would take a subject and then we would practice with it for a few months. And then he'd take another subject and we'd practice with it for a few months. And then this learning to be in Sangha, learning to be with the mess of Sangha and the beauty of Sangha and beginning to see that interacting with people, getting to feel connected. You see that we are all the same. We come from all these different backgrounds. We got all this different stuff. We got all these different family problems and family dynamics and worldly dynamics. And yet, we are all the same. We're very much interconnected. So to see that, you can begin to get this utmost singleness as to what you really are, who we really are as human beings. And this is what I realized when I was lying there. I realized I am very connected to the Dhamma. I have spent my time, my life, you know, years having to find mindfulness in the midst of raging anger. And at the time, I did not think I would ever not be raging and angry. I just never would have, if someone had told me back then, oh, you're going to be very still and quiet, walk around all day in a house that doesn't have any sounds, and you're happy, I would say, that's not going to happen. I mean, yeah, no. I got to have the TV going, noise, all kinds of drama. But no, it's very different. And it's not because I somehow have gotten better. I just feel secluded in mindfulness. And it came from practicing mindfulness in all kinds of situations and never judging whether or not this is, I'm doing good or not doing good. I did for a long time, but I stopped that. I just started assuming as long as I'm thinking about mindfulness, even this much, it's good enough. Good enough. I'm doing good. Because I can remember when mindfulness was like out the door, down the street a few blocks, and I don't even see it or hear it. So this cultivating mindfulness, cultivating an understanding of the Dhamma, being interested in it, and being a part of a Sangha, that is what cultivated this seclusion that I had. So this is what I'm going to point to, how that cultivation of this seclusion is what gives us an unshakable peace. I don't really care what happens in the political world. I assume it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I know as long as I'm connected to the Sangha, to Dhamma, and to mindfulness, I'll be okay. I'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. I will not be alone in any of it. And so even though I'm talking about seclusion, I will not be alone. I will not be without community. And so for that, you know, I figure we could take on pretty much anything as long as we stay together. Anyway, that's what I want to talk about. I just want to talk about that all year. I want to talk about it here, talk about it there, talk about it all year, just to remind us of the gift we have being born in a time where we have access to the Dhamma. So let's just sit for a moment here, and then we'll see if anybody has any questions and comments. All right. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Appreciate it.